If you want to mark the invitation song, that'll be number 902. 902. We'll listen for the cue when I wind up here. That actually, song leading is such an interesting and difficult matter to undertake in the worship service. There are so many things that potentially can go wrong, and song leaders have had them all go wrong at different times. We've all done that. I distinctly remember, Cecil, the very first time I led singing after I was baptized. I'd been a Christian about, a week. They handed me a songbook. I knew maybe three songs in the songbook, and they said that I was the song leader that night. And I led my three songs, and I scampered out of the front to go sit down. I wouldn't tell them the invitation song either. I'm getting out of there now, I'm telling you. Well, things change. Time goes by. About 22 or 23 years ago, I was preaching in a little country town in northwest Missouri, Albany, Missouri, and we got about four radio stations, I think. We had one television station and about four radio stations we could get. One of those radio stations was the local station from the college where I could listen to National Public Radio. There was a morning show on Fridays on NPR called All Things Considered with a guy named Bob Edwards, and he had on Friday mornings a telephone guest. He always called Red Barber in Florida, and Red Barber and he would talk sports for 5 or 6 minutes. Red Barber had been the voice of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1940s and 50s, and just an absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of baseball particularly, but all kinds of sports. He's just a fascinating man to listen to and had this just golden voice. Anyway, one day I was listening. I remember the conversation. They just hooked up the phone call, and they're talking on the phone, and Red Barber said, "I read that Charlie Keller died the other day." And he said, "Charlie Keller had been a New York Yankee baseball player." He said, "Charlie Keller was the strongest man in baseball. They used to call him King Kong Keller." And he just terrified the other players because he was so incredibly strong. And he said, "When you think about a man like that, with that kind of immense physical power, dying, you need to go read the 39th Psalm." Oh, that was a marvelous comment to throw out on National Public Radio. It's time for you to read the 39th Psalm. And now I can't read the 39th Psalm without hearing Red Barber saying, "You need to go read the 39th Psalm there." Now, we read that Psalm in our daily Bible reading this past week, and I want to go there. So go ahead and turn to the 39th Psalm tonight. We're going to take a look at this. It's a psalm of David, and as the king, David had his court there, and he's on the throne, and he's got to judge these various things. He's got various officials around him, and some of them are smart, and some of them are not too smart, and some of them are proud and arrogant. He had to listen to an amazing amount of foolishness, which is par for the course, I think, for anyone in any position of great authority where they have people clustered around them, advisors and so on. Some of them really just thought they were so incredibly shrewd as they dealt unrighteously with people. And the longer he listened to them, apparently, the more angry David got. And so the first three verses of this psalm just have his irritation just spewing out. Let's just take a look at the first three verses here. He's just tired of listening to this foolishness that's going on around him. "I said, I will watch my ways, keep my tongue from sin. I'll put a muzzle on my mouth as long as the wicked are in my presence. But when I was silent and still, not even saying anything good, my anguish increased. My heart grew hot within me. And as I meditated, the fire burned, then I spoke with my tongue." So everything that pours out of here after this is all based on David's irritation. He just had enough. He didn't listen to these knotheads all day long. Now let me tell you how things really are. And the rest of the psalm now is kind of a meditation on the reality of life. What we see in this life is very temporary and unreal. We're aware of that, I think. And servants of God certainly know about a greater reality that is beyond the physical realm that we enjoy day to day. It really is good for us to stop and just look at the big picture. Just look at the big picture and kind of think about our future and what's going to happen to us in the future. in this meditation in Psalm 39 here, there are about, I guess, about three big ideas that we really need to keep close to our hearts. And if we do that, if we can keep those ideas close to our hearts, that will keep us thinking forward in our lives and really living in the shadow of eternal life. And the first big idea that comes up in this meditation is so obvious, and it terrifies the world. Everyone has noticed this for as long as recorded history, and yet the idea still terrifies the world. The first idea is life is short. Life is just short. Start reading with me, if you would, in verse 4. We're going to read down through verse 6, and just we'll take this next little chunk. Now, here's what he's saying. He's heard enough. You know, all these knotheads around here, I got to tell the truth here. So we're going to spew here just for a minute. He's going to let them have it. Show me, O Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting is my life. You've made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Each man's life is but a breath. Man is a mere phantom as he goes to and fro. He bustles about, but only in vain. He heaps up wealth, not knowing who will get it. Just think about it. Life is short. I think it's really good for us to consider this a very wise observation. It's recorded in the Bible in several places. You know, way over in the New Testament, the book of James, he says, what is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. We need to think about this. It's a great literary theme. Came up in all kinds of literary works. One of the earliest Latin epigrams is Vita brevis est, ars longa, which literally just means life is short and art lasts. That same idea has been picked up by Shakespeare, picked up by Longfellow in his Psalm of Life. He pointed out that art is long and or life is short, and art is long. It's good for us to remember that life is short, doesn't last very long, just the blink of an eye across the face of eternity. And if we could do that, if we could just remember that life is short, boy, oh boy, it would give us a lot more accurate judgment in life, wouldn't it? It would help us to remember what things are important, what things really are not very important. Oh, they seem so important right now, and people work so hard to get these things worked out. In 2007, I started looking for things that people sometimes think are important, and all of us would agree are pretty foolish. In 2007... a guy in Cornwall, England, decided that he would get into the Guinness Book of World Records. He is going to set the world's record for staying awake. The former record had been 264 hours. He thought that had been set in 1964. Well, he is ready. He is ready. 2007, he's going to go for it. He's going to get across that 264-hour mark. He's going to stay awake longer than anybody else. He'd get his name in the Guinness Book of World Records. Made it to 266 hours. 266 hours. That's better than 10 days. That's almost 2 weeks he stayed awake. What's the point? There is no point. He thought it was so terribly important. He found out later that the record was actually way over 300 hours. He didn't even get it done. You think, oh, how futile is that? I mean, this guy devoted all this time and energy to figuring out how to do this for nothing, absolutely nothing. And even if he had accomplished his goal, who cares? Do you know that right now there are people staying up, they're working 12, 14, 16-hour days, sacrificing time with their children, their families, to write iPhone applications? In 10 years, no one will be using an iPhone. They seem so hot and cool and happening right now. 10 years, no one will have one. I won't even have an iPhone. I'm like the last guy to adopt this stuff. I won't even have one. These people are chasing absolute vanity and futility if they just think about the fact that life is short. Might stay a little bit better focused on what things are really important. You know, we try to ignore this fact, but it's still there. Life is short. death is out there in our future. I mean, it's going to be out there. Death is out there in our future. The odd thing about death now is it is considered a shameful thing. You know, polite people don't do that. You have to go someplace. You go to someplace sterile and antiseptic. You don't want to do that at your house. You know, you don't want to die at your own house. No, you got to someplace sterile and antiseptic where professionals will look after you and clean it all up when it's all over. Professionals clean it all up when it's all over. See, we really ought to consider how short life is, I think. David expressed it really well here. Each man's life is but a breath. Well, to God, that's certainly true. God breathed in the breath of life into us. Each man's life is but a breath. 1981, the writer William Saroyan died. One of the things that he said, he'd been diagnosed with a terminal illness, had a little time to prepare for it, and he said, "Everyone has got to die. But I had always thought an exception would be made in my case. Now what? Now what?" Well, that's a big question, you know that? Now what? You know, life is short. And David, you know, he's listened to these guys, and the first thing that comes to his mind is, life is short. And all, you know, your shrewd observations here, the things you're trying to cook out here and get done, it's all worthless, guys. You need to take the big view and look ahead. First thing he says is life is short. Second thing he says is, you know what really matters is your position with God. Again, this is so obvious, it hardly needs to be said. But let's start in verse 7. Listen to what he has to say here. We'll read down through verse 11. What really matters is my position with God. But now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. Save me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of fools. I was silent. I would not open my mouth, for you're the one who has done this. Remove your scourge from me. I'm overcome by the blow of your hand. You rebuke and discipline men for their sin. You consume their wealth like a moth. Each man is but a breath. Yeah, we just heard that, didn't we? Each man is but a breath. What matters the most in all this is my position with God. You know, there are really, salvation has two different parts that are involved with it. First part is that forgiveness of sins thing. And that is super important to us. We really want that. We want to be standing in a right relationship with God. Forgiveness of sins is a really important part of salvation. Save me from all my transgressions, he said in verse 8. I ain't that forgiveness thing for sure. You know what the other part of it is? Behavior change. His salvation involves forgiveness of sins and behavior change, right? Stop doing the wrong stuff and start doing the right stuff instead. And so he says, do not make me the scorn of fools. The scorn of fools. When you act like an idiot out there and everybody knows you act like an idiot, even the fools will stand around and scorn you. People who would have done the very same thing, they'll stand around and make the big jokes about you. And we have seen, we've been watching that unfold for the last few months, haven't we? You cannot turn the television on without being confronted with somebody's shameful behavior, and that makes them a late night joke. And who are the guys on late night to make jokes like that? Do not make me the scorn of fools. Immoral people just love to mock other people's failure. I don't know if that makes them feel better about their own problems or what. They just love it. They just love it. We often interpret pain in our lives as punishment. And it really may have been true in David's case. You know, where he says, remove your scourge from me. I'm overcome by the blow of your hand. We tend to interpret pain as punishment. David may have had it right because, you know, he had the value of inspiration working on his side. It may have been God's punishment of him. I do know that pain gets our attention like nothing else in the world will get our attention. Things are not working well. And when we suffer, we usually, I think, take a moment to examine our standing with God, see how things are going. Have I been true to Him? Have I done His will? Is this what's supposed to happen in my life? What matters is my position with God, because our future is with God. That's how he started this section in verse 7. But now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. My hope is in you. We have a really short time here. An eternity waits out there. Now, that's reality. This is kind of insubstantial. All of this seems so permanent and strong, but the reality is not very long, probably less than 200 years, all of this is going to be gone. But eternity will still be there and still be going on. Life is short. Boy, eternity just goes on and on and on. Hope draws us forward. Hope is what leads us onward. We want to be there. We want to be there with God. We want to be in eternity with Him. And it's that hope that we have that the Hebrew writer calls an anchor for our souls. That's the thing that really keeps us grounded so that we really understand what's going on. We understand that life is really, really short, and we understand that eternity is really out there. That's reality. And those two ideas coupled together really just keep us firmly rooted in our lives and don't let us get too taken with the things that are going on around us. We don't lose perspective on what's happening around us. And as David is meditating on these two big ideas, life is really short, and what matters most is my position with God, the last thing he says is something that, again, I think we just really need to take to heart, and that is that we're just strangers here. You know, we really don't live here. This really isn't our place. Well, so we start in verse 12 and read down through the end of the psalm. We're just strangers here. I guess that takes us all the way to verse 13, doesn't it? That's it. Verse 12, verse 13. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Listen to my cry for help. Do not be deaf, or be not deaf to my weeping, for I dwell with you as an alien, a stranger, as all my fathers were. Look away from me that I may rejoice again before I depart and am no more. We're strangers here. We probably shouldn't get too comfortable here. Some of you are saying, no danger of that. Well, we do get comfortable, though. That's part of our problem. We tend to get used to just about anything. But we sing the song, This World Is Not My Home, and we ought to take that to heart, too. You know, we had Giovanni and Carolina and Gabriel Tellez here, and they had a pretty good time. It was a time of relaxation for them. At the same time, they were busy, had a lot of things they needed to accomplish while they were here in the States. But what was interesting to me is they were living here at a level of luxury that they do not experience at home. There were a lot of things, you know, turn on the electricity, you turn on the light, and the light comes on every time without fail. That's pretty cool. When you live in Nicaragua, that's not going to happen all the time. And they shut the power off. You turn the tap and the water would run. That doesn't happen every day either in Nicaragua. You know, you had different times when the water's turned off. But the thing that really captured Carolina's interest, it captured her interest last time and this time again, she's just fascinated by the dishwasher. A dishwasher. You know, you got this magic box there, and you put the dirty pans in there, close the door, push a few buttons, go away for an hour or so, come back, and they're clean. This is great. They do not have dishwashers in Nicaragua. Anywhere. No one has dishwashers. Because people come too cheap. So they're living in a level of luxury that they've never experienced. Also, I might add, in a level of cold they've never experienced. They were not prepared for this cold weather. But with all the luxury that surrounded them, they could not wait to get home. You know, they liked being here, loved seeing you, and they liked being around the other churches, shake hands all around. Brethren, great to see you. See you later. And they wanted to get back home because as nice as it might have been, it just wasn't home. And that's the way we ought to feel about it, too. As nice as it is, it's just not home. And it's not really where we belong. There was an unjustly convicted prisoner, spent many years in the state pen. DNA testing or something finally exonerated him. He never was guilty of that crime that he'd been charged with. And he was released some people commented on how easily he slipped back into civilian life, out of the prison, back in. A lot of prisoners have a very difficult time making that adjustment from being in prison to being free again. He didn't have trouble with that at all. And they said, why not? What was it that let you kind of adjust back and just slide back into society so easily? And he said, I never decorated my cell. Everybody decorates their cell. You see, they put up pictures or whatever, but he never did. It never was home to him. And so when the door opened, he walked out very easily and naturally. We kind of need to look at our lives like that, too, I think. This world just is not our home. We shouldn't get too comfortable. For one thing, we're in the stream of generations. I dwell with you as an alien, a stranger as all my fathers were. You know, the thing about David's fathers is they were all dead. They were all aliens and strangers like he was, but all the fathers are dead. When your parents die, there's something very sobering about that, I think, because you realize that puts you on the top step. You know, there aren't any generations ahead of you now. You're on the top step of the ladder. And the next one to step off is you. It gives you pause. You got to stop and think about this a little bit. We are all impermanent here. And we're just borrowing the bodies that we inhabit, and we're borrowing the material goods around us. We really can't own them permanently. They're not going to stay with us. You know that. And that's not just some morbid gloom we sit around and think, everybody's going to die. No, it's just truth and reality. We just have to come to grips with it and be okay with it, because that's the way the universe really is. Because we're not going to stay here. We have a home. This isn't it. We have a home, though. David says, look away from me that I may rejoice again before I depart and am no more. He really doesn't want God to ignore him. What he's saying is, don't pick on me anymore. You know, don't look at me looking for fault and picking at me anymore, because I've got this very brief time before I depart. And what's interesting about that word, that's a very interesting word in the original language. It literally means to pick up and go on a journey. Before I get up and go on my journey and am no more, we've all got a journey to make. We're on our way someplace. You know, a journey implies a destination, too. So we're going to take a journey. We've got a different destination to go to. We're just strangers here. At the same time we were living up there in northwest Missouri, there's a lot of good things to enjoy about that. We lived in a farmhouse. And a guy was leasing the pasture around us. All we had was the house. And the guy was running some cattle out there. And one early spring, there was a calf that was wandering around out there, just a little bit away from its mama. Certainly wasn't weaned, wasn't old enough to be grazing. But he's got his nose down in the grass, pushing it around. You know, seeing the older cows doing that, thinks that's what cows do. You know, I got to get my nose down in the grass, do the same thing. So he's wandering around out there, got his nose in the grass, pushing along. And he walked under a barbed wire gate. Never even knew it was there. I mean, he's a little guy, right? Just walked right. Got his head down in the grass, walked right under this gate. Looked up and found himself on the wrong side of the fence from Mama. This is a bad idea. And all of a sudden, he realized he's in trouble. You know, what are you going to do now? You're on the wrong side of the fence. How do you get back? And there was quite a lot of noise about that until I went out and opened the gate and let him walk back in. Okay, they're not noted for their intelligence either, okay? But, it struck me that that's kind of how we get into trouble, too. We, instead of looking up, we're looking down. We're looking down at our shoes. We're looking down at the things right around us. And we just kind of go browsing around here. And before we know it, we're in the wrong place. And we look around, can't figure out how to get back. The reason our eyes are stuck on the front of our heads is so that we can look forward. We need to look forward in life, I think. We need to think forward in life and see where we're heading. Whenever we think about life and death and who we are and what's to come, I think it's really good. I think Red Barber had a sharp point there where he said, you need to read the 39th Psalm. Show me, O Lord, my life and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting is my life. And we need to realize, I think, that the ultimate preparation for this journey that we're all going to take, we're all going to take the journey. So, preparation for that ultimate journey certainly depends on our position with God. And by His grace, salvation and redemption can be found in Jesus Christ. There are still two parts to salvation. There's forgiveness and there's behavior change. There is forgiveness in that we can come to God, and in His grace and through Jesus' sacrifice, His blood will forgive our sins. If we believe that Jesus is the Son of God, repent of sin, confess His name, and are baptized for the forgiveness of our sins, we can be raised to walk in newness of life. But that newness of life, folks, includes behavior change. We actually have to be transformed and changed to be more like Him day by day. And so we're going to sing an invitation song and give you an opportunity. Not because we're terrified of death. We're not terrified of death. Christians are not terrified of death. That's the one good thing we have going for us. We just recognize that it really is there. And we need to be prepared for it. We need to be prepared for life, too. So if you're not a Christian, we're going to sing an invitation song, give you an opportunity to respond to Jesus' invitation, come to Him, and obtain the forgiveness that you can have. If you are a Christian, though, you've made the covenant with Christ in the past, you just haven't been living for Him, haven't lived with Him, haven't really thought about doing His will, you're ignoring one whole side of your redemption. You need to be transformed to be like Him. That's our goal in this life, so that the next life will be the seamless continuation of our lives as we want it to be. If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now while we stand and sing the song.
Transformation process begins